You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later this hour, we'll find out about a crucial bridge in Green Bay that's sinking and what it means for the city.
Jim Henson is known far and wide for his lovable, furry Muppets who make people laugh, helped educate kids, and have gone on to have influential lives beyond their creator. Most of us know more about Kermit and Big Bird than the man who gave him life.
Brian J. Jones joins us now to help remedy that. He's the author of Jim Henson, the biography. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks.
Well, I have to say I was a little bit nervous about your book because I thought I might be devastated to find out if the guy who created Jim Henson, you know, Jim Henson who created Big Bird, Miss Piggy, he had a dark, seamy side. But I'm glad to say that, you know, Jim Henson seems like a nice guy. Tell us a little bit about who he was.
Yeah, he's pretty much as you think he is. He's dazzlingly inspirational, and people really wanted to be around him and work with him and were inspired by him. And wherever he was always felt very special, and people liked when he was around to work with. So he was, you know, this guy who did amazing puppets and figured out how to make puppets work on TV. But once he did that, he was more than just Muppets. He did really great experimental film projects like The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth, and did really interesting, sort of slightly dangerous commercials in the 60s with things blowing each other up and eating each other, and made his name on variety shows in the 60s, and then totally made Sesame Street a household name, was on the first season of Saturday Night Live. I mean, the list goes on and on, all these iconic things that Jim did.
He seems like just this walking vortex of creativity. What did people say about him, you know, talking about just being in a room with them?
Well, John Stone, from one of the creators of Sesame, he said he would have been creatively restless had he lived to be 109 years old. You know, he was one of these guys who, it's sort of like a duck. It's floating on the surface very calm, and underneath they're paddling like crazy. Jim was always working, always pitching, always had projects he was developing or thinking about. And for everything that made it on the screen, he had, you know, 10 or 20 or 50 things that never got off of the page. He just sort of had this creativity that just constantly was working. He was always in motion.
And tell us about the birth of the Muppets. You talked about this creative streak that he definitely carried with him his whole life, but where did the famous Muppets first come from in their first form?
Well, Jim, the Muppet name came very early on, but Jim actually built his first Muppets and got on TV when he was still a senior in high school. What Jim really wanted to do more than anything else was be on television. Jim didn't really want to be a puppeteer. There's always sort of this urban legend that Jim must have loved puppets and must have played with them all the time as a kid, and that's not the case at all. He even said, I never really played with puppets as a kid. I never went to puppet shows. He watched Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, but then everybody did. So a newspaper ad was taken out here in Washington looking for puppeteers to perform on a local TV show, Jim said, okay, well, there's my way in the door. I'm going to go down there and tell them I'm a puppeteer. So he learned how to build puppets and perform puppets almost overnight, auditioned and got that job, and got into TV as a puppeteer. And then it turned out he was just so good at it that he just kept getting jobs as a puppeteer.
When did he first go out and do an act with the actual Muppet label?
As early as 1955, he was in at that point a freshman in college. He had invented that name in 1955 or even late 1954, and that sort of became his brand name even early on. So they were always the Muppets almost from day one, which is really, really interesting.
And Kermit seems to hold, you know, that place of honor. And you couldn't help wondering, he was born in Mississippi. It seems like he spent a lot of time out of doors. Was there something there about Kermit being sort of part of him, about part of where he came from?
Yeah, Kermit's that sort of, you know, homespun, you know, literally swampy. You know, he's sort of that homespun, thoughtful person, which is the way Jim was. And I always said in the book, there's times when you could take Jim out of the swamp, but you could never completely take it out of him. Jim loved, you know, he loved jazz music, and he even at his funeral, he asked that they play When the Saints Go Marching In. He always just loved that jazz. But Jim loved the outdoors. He loved to just lay in a field and look up at the trees and found inspiration in the stars and in the trees. And even in the Muppet Workshop, and they purchased this beautiful townhouse in New York to build the Muppet Workshop, and it was this three-story old townhouse. And at the very top of the stairways, there was a skylight, and it was called Kermit's View or something like that. And it was what it would have looked like if you'd been sitting on a lily pad looking up at the stars from a lily pad.
Well, let's give a listen to a clip from The Muppet Show where it all really kind of came together. We'll give a listen.
Sylvester Stallone, 15 seconds to curtain, Mr. Stallone. Everything okay?
Oh, yeah, I'm happy as a clam. I'm so miserable.
My back hurts.
I gotta work overtime tonight.
Well, happy at some clench.
It's the Muppet Show with our very special guest star, Sylvester Stallone. Yay!
And a clip there, of course, from The Muppet Show. You know, one of the things I find so interesting about The Muppets is that the people who worked with them, you had these celebrities, they were on Saturday Night Live. The people who interacted with them seemed to have no trouble treating them like they were real. How did they reach that level of, you know, just being like a person?
Yeah, they were. It was great design, great building, and just spectacular performing. You know, Jim had the Muppets sewn. They called it the Henson Stitch. You could not see the stitch on Kermit's face. They wanted to make sure you couldn't see that on TV. But there's always it's the purity of that performance that makes them absolutely believable. And you see it on Sesame Street. You watch clips on Sesame Street. The kids, you know, Jim's crouched just out of sight. They are never looking down. They are watching that puppet, and they believe in it absolutely. You watch footage of Rolf the dog on the Jimmy Dean show in the 60s even. Jimmy Dean believes in that character completely. Children would say, they would see Jim with Ernie, and they would say something like, oh, that's just Ernie's helper. They didn't even really, you know, click that this was the guy doing it. And on The Muppet Show, as soon as the puppets went up, they were absolutely believable. The director, one of the directors, Peter Harris, said he would call down to the floor and say, Jim, why don't you move to the left or maybe try that again? And he said Kermit would turn around and answer. And Peter Harris said, you know, at that point, it's just easier just to talk to the puppets at that point.
Well, you think about somebody like Steve Jobs at Apple having that control over everything around him. Was it like that for Jim Henson and the various incarnations of the Muppets, or was there really a strong collaborative feel?
Jim was the ultimate collaborator, and he kind of was Kermit in that regard. He was the eye of the hurricane. Things would go crazy around him, and people were moving around, and there were things going on, and there were meetings to go to, and things were crazy, and there were deadlines. And Muppet writer Jerry Joel said if it were a basketball game, the score would always be Chaos 98, the Frog 99. That Jim was always going to be just one step ahead of that. It was never going to be too much for him to handle. And he worked unbelievably long hours, especially when he was doing the Muppet Show in London. You know, he'd be up till 11 o'clock at night, and he'd get up early in the morning for story meetings. The guy just had an amazing work ethic. But people really responded to that. They really wanted to please Jim. They loved it if they could make Jim laugh. That was the ultimate compliment for them, is if you could make Jim Henson laugh.
You know, I was thinking about it looking back now, and it seems kind of crazy that this half-hour show was devoted to Muppets and tons of people watched it and it was successful. Can you talk a little bit about the glory days of The Muppet Show and why it was so successful?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons it was so successful is it was genuine family entertainment. It was smart comedy that didn't mind looking silly. So kids enjoyed it. Their parents could enjoy it on a different level. It was the place where you could go and see celebrities doing something they didn't do anywhere else. You just played the Sylvester Stallone clip. Sylvester Stallone sang and danced on The Muppet Show. You know, you would have Beverly Sills hanging a spoon off her nose. I mean, you just gave the celebrities this sort of free rein to do anything they wanted, which made that show so unpredictable and so much fun. But the British really embraced them even more quickly than we did. Jim was producing The Muppet Show in London. He got the opportunity to do that from Lord Grade in London, who really believed in him and really backed that show and really put his money where his mouth was. And the Muppets, in their first season, were gigantic over there. It was almost like Beatlemania. Jim even says in his journal at one point, it's this whole Muppet Mania thing over here. They had a bus that would take the performers from their homes out to the studio in Elstree, and it said The Muppet Show on the side. They had to take the sign off the side because the bus would get mobbed at stoplights. I mean, it was unbelievable. The magazines over there would follow the Muppet Men, you know, Jim and all the Muppet performers, and talk about characters they were introducing. It was just it was crazy for them. I mean, the British got it early, and they really liked. They wanted to claim them as their own. There was one story that says something like, "They're ours. We've nicked them, and so they're ours now." They really liked being able to say that The Muppet Show was made in London. It took a little longer to find its audience in the United States, but not that long. But it was at a time when networks kind of, because there weren't as many networks as there are now, would give a show the luxury of kind of, you know, finding its way a little bit. Nowadays, they probably would have yanked it quicker. They would have yanked it. It never got yanked. Jim pulled it off the air. They probably might have yanked it and not given it the time it needed to really kind of find its way, which it did in a relative hurry. but by network standards, it was a little bit of a slow pace.
Well, as we go into a little break for news, let's listen to one more clip.
Kermit, about this Elton John.
Yeah?
I have seen some pretty weird guests on this show, but this Elton John borders on the revolutionary.
Sam, Elton John is a very important musician.
Then why does he dress like a stolen car?
Sam, musicians have always been fancy dressers.
Mozart wasn't.
Mozart wore high heels and wigs and silk stockings.
Hold your little green tongue.
It's true, Sam.
Oh, if Mozart wore high heels, wigs, and stockings, I'll eat my hat.
And give Elton John a big introduction?
That too.
Hey, guys, look at this great picture of Mozart Elton John gave me. What? Those high heels and silk stockings.
What?
Hey, Sam, you know, you'd look great in a powdered wig.
Good grief. I've been hornswoggled.
Okay, guys, come
on. A little bit there. That was with Sam the Eagle and Kermit discussing the wardrobe of Elton John. We're talking now with Brian J. Jones about his new book called Jim Henson, the Biography.
And you can join in. Do you have a favorite Muppet or a favorite Muppet memory or some other part of Jim Henson's career? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking Muppets now and the life and times of Jim Henson, their creator. Brian J. Jones is with us now. He's the author of Jim Henson, the Biography.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your cherished Muppet memory, 800-642-1234, or go to our Facebook page, Central Time on WPR. Brian, we've been talking about The Muppet Show a lot. Obviously, another big impact for Jim Henson is Sesame Street. I want to give a listen to one of his main characters there. We'll give a clip of Bert and Ernie.
Hey, Aaron, what are you doing?
Hi, Bert. Well, I'm taking care of Mr. Hooper's store for a couple of minutes. And I saw you coming, and you know what I did?
What?
I made you your favorite drink. See that?
Look at that.
Mm-hmm.
Aha!
It's a tall, cool glass of unflavored soda water, Bert.
Yeah.
That's your favorite drink.
My favorite. That's for me, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. Great. I'll take it.
Just 1 second, Bert. You see, first I just want to taste it and make sure it's okay for my old buddy Bert.
Oh, I'm sure it's okay, Ernie. Hey, come on.
Spoiler alert. I don't think Bert ever really gets to drink that drink. Brian, how did that collaboration, Jim Henson and his Muppets and Sesame Street, come together?
The original team was putting together Sesame Street in the late 60s. They wanted to have puppets on Sesame Street as part of what made the learning fun. That was the big thing Sesame Street was going to do. It was going to be sort of curriculum-based, which education shows really weren't at that time, but also sort of like laugh in. They wanted it to be funny and fast-paced and almost have commercials for things, which is why it's always brought to you by the letter Q. And some of the people inside Sesame Street said, we got to have puppets on here, but if you cannot get Jim Henson, you should not do puppets on Sesame Street.
Wow.
He was that important to the deal. They got him, of course, and Jim created all these iconic characters. And what's really fun about Ernie and Bert is, you know, Jim loved that study in horizontal and vertical. It was like two competing different visions. You had Ernie, who was very horizontal and laid back, and Bert, who's very uptight and vertical. And he and Frank Oz, Jim does Ernie and Frank Oz does Bert, but in the first time they stand in front of a mirror with those puppets, there's a picture of them with the other character. And so the two of them really sort of had to play around for a while and figure out who was going to do what. And after the fact, people said, you know, it couldn't have gone any other way because Jim is Bert. I mean, I'm sorry, Jim is Ernie, and Frank Oz is Bert. Frank's very sort of buttoned up and uptight, and Jim is laid back and really knows how to push Frank and Bert's buttons. So they said that was Jim and Frank. But a lot of those routines, the other thing that makes them really fun is Frank said they would talk them around. So they sort of knew they had an educational aspect they had to hit. But they would say, okay, well, let's make sure we get that, and we'll talk our way around it. And then it was off to the races. They would ad-lib a lot of it. So a lot of that is sort of seat-of-the-pants, Muppet-style performing, just Jim and Frank Oz having a great time and somehow sneezing your nose off into a handkerchief. It's educational. So, it all worked.
Yeah, and it sounds like fun. Well, let's go to the phones now. Amelia is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Amelia.
Hi there.
What do you think about the Muppets?
I love the Muppets. And I especially, I am a tattoo historian, and I especially love the episode in the first season where there is a tattooed Muppet that kind of looks like Miss Piggy dancing and singing with Kermit to Lydia the Tattooed Lady. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with that Muppet and if you know anything about it and whatever happened to it.
Yeah, Jim actually drew all those tattoos on that puppet himself. I can't remember the name of that character off the top of my head, but he did draw those tattoos on that puppet. And you're right, it was Kermit singing Lydia the Tattooed Lady, you know, from the old Marx Brothers film, too.
Huh. Interesting. I don't remember that one. Well, thanks so much for the call, and let's go to Shirley in Eau Claire. Hey, Shirley, you're on the air.
Hi. I want you to know my two favorite characters were Miss Piggy and Kermit the Frog. I thought those two were meant for each other. Jim was my hero because, you know, I used to watch that show.
Oh, well, those are favorites
he was
for sure.
Super, right? The way he did all the characters, you know, he amazed me.
Great.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Shirley.
Brian, Miss Piggy we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah, Miss Piggy is sort of the quintessential Hollywood story. That character, that puppet, started off as sort of a back row character. They used her over in the UK for, I think, a Herb Alpert special. And then she was in sort of one of the rough drafts of the Muppet Show called Muppet Show Sex and Violence, and they had done a parody in there called Beneath the Planet of the Pigs. And Miss Piggy's in there, too, but she's not Miss Piggy yet. She's just sort of this nameless background pig. When they got her into the Muppet Show, they were using her there as well, but they didn't really have the personality for her yet. And in fact, she was kind of passed around between two different performers, Frank Oz and Richard Hunt. So you watch the early seasons of The Muppet Show. Her voice is off sometimes. She's not acting like Miss Piggy all the time. But there was one stage direction finally where Miss Piggy was supposed to give Kermit a slap. And Frank Oz, who had Piggy at that time, decided to make it a karate chop. And as soon as she hit him with that karate chop, it said the place just went crazy. They knew that was it immediately. But that's another example of Jim giving his performers the room to experiment and figure it out and find these characters. And then what's so great about that, too, is Frank Oz, once he had Piggy and that character took off, Fozzie was sort of supposed to be his big character, and they had to sort of move Fozzie to the background a little bit because Piggy was taking all the time and attention that Oz needed.
We have a question from Kevin in Verona. I have a theory about the answer. Let's see what you say. He asks if you can address where the names Bert and Ernie came from.
Well, there is an urban myth or an urban legend that they came from the cop and the, I think, taxi driver from It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, that was my guess, but it's an urban legend, huh?
That's a coincidence. Now, Jim did have a great uncle named Ernie, and uncle named Ernie and a great uncle named Fritz. But I'm not positive if Ernie was named after his uncle. He also had a great grandfather named Oscar, if that is illuminating at all. But Ernie and Bert, it was just, you know, sort of funny names that went together. But whether it was based on A Wonderful Life, Jim, they always said no. That was not the case.
Now I want to skip ahead a little to the end of his life. He died young, and he was a Christian Scientist, as I understand it. And you write that he always sort of had this sense that he was not going to be around for a very, very long life. Can you talk a little bit about the final days and what that was like? We've only got about a minute or so left.
Yeah. Jim had a strep infection that he didn't know was quite so serious. He had been raised Christian Science, but he was not a practicing Christian Science. So that actually had no effect on his decision not to go to the hospital. He didn't go to the hospital, I think, mainly because Jim's a guy. One of the stories I tell is I got swine flu in London when I was researching this book and thought I was going to die and didn't do anything because that's kind of what guys do. Nobody ever thinks they're really critically ill. So Jim just sort of waited and thought he would get through it and had people in his apartment giving him soup and rubbing his back and just trying to calm him down, take a bath. And finally, he got to the point where he realized he probably needed to go to a hospital. And by the time he did, it was too late. The strep had just sort of ravaged his system. And you read his medical records, and it's just awful. He was unconscious almost immediately when he got into the hospital, and died, I think, less than a day later. So,
Brian, can you leave us with a favorite memory, something that we should revisit, popular or obscure, from Jim Henson's career?
I open the book with a scene that I absolutely love. It's from Sesame Street, and it's sort of indicative of the way Jim worked. They brought a little girl named Joey in who was going to perform with him, and they loved to put the Muppet performers, and especially Jim, with children and just see what would happen. It wasn't ever scripted. And on this particular day, they brought this little girl in, and they said, okay, you're going to sing the ABCs with this little girl. And this is the little girl who started singing A, B, C, and at about every other letter would say Cookie Monster and just giggle uncontrollably. And Jim, if you watch that sketch, what I love about it is at one point, Jim very nearly breaks. You'll hear him kind of snicker, and then he gets it back together and continues on as Kermit, and it is just magical. This girl absolutely believes in that puppet.
Well, we are going to have
to keep her hands off of it.
We're going to have to check that out. Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Brian J. Jones, an award-winning biographer whose latest book is called Jim Henson, The Biography.
Coming up after the news, we'll find out where to check out the best fall color in Wisconsin. Stick around. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.